Hey everybody, thanks for tuning in today. I have a special guest I'm going to be talking with, Roman Bistrionic, is that correct?
Bistrionic, yeah, you got it.
So Roman is an author of the book, co-author of the book Dissolving Illusions, which is a book I read several years ago, and it was one of the books that sort of woke me up to the history of the medical system, kind of woke me up to the sort of like secret medical history of virology and the vaccine industry. And I've been really looking forward to this conversation, doing a bit of a deep dive into the history of the sort of like medical system going back a couple hundred years, actually. And we'll kind of gradually bring it up to date and then talk about a few other pressing topics that Roman is currently engaged with. So, yeah, thanks very much for joining me.
Awesome.
So we had a little bit of a pre-interview chat, and which I really enjoyed. And I really like the story that you told of how you first got into researching this field and how you – the sort of backstory about how your book with Dr. Susan Humphreys came about. And that was published back in 2013. If it's not too tedious – would you mind just kind of going over a little bit of that with us? And I think that'll be a good intro to getting into some of the issues that we'll be talking about.
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, this is like 20 years ago, 20 plus years ago. I had started doing some listening to various radio programs about vaccination because I had kids. I had kids at the time, young kids, and I really just wanted to do the best for them. And I had already kind of transitioned to learning about some alternative medicine in the years before that. But, you know, at the time I was listening to these programs, I heard things like autism and neurological damage. And, you know, I thought, well, I hope that doesn't happen, but I'm not too worried about it because they're probably pretty rare events and it's horrible that it happens. But on balance, you know, I knew that these diseases were tamed by vaccination. At least that's, you know, what I believed. And I don't know how I believe that. It was something that I knew was true. So I picked up some books and I was going through, I think it was Neil Miller's book. And in there, he had a chart showing that there was a 95% decline in mortality before the vaccine. And I looked at that, and I just thought, that can't be true. It just can't be true. I decided, well, I'm not going to, you know, this guy is probably just selling books or he just put something ridiculous in his book. But I decided, you know, I'm going to go check on that. So I went to a local library, and I found a couple almanacs. I finally found one that had mortality rate every 10 years for measles. So there was like 7 data points. And I had a piece of graph paper with me. So I charted it, and it was the same thing. It was a 95% decline in mortality before the vaccine. And I sat there for a while with a kind of probably a dumb look on my face, like, that can't be true. That can't be true. You just kind of shattered a belief system for me. It just didn't seem possible. But there was the data sitting in front of me, and I was like, well, I guess it must be true. Then what I thought was incorrect. I learned something new
Let me just jump in for a second. I gotta say, I'm really impressed that you went and did this sort of firsthand research. Had you ever done anything like that in terms of checking the sources?
Previous to that, I had been years before that, 10 years before that, I was just a regular guy. And, you know, an engineering background. So I have training in statistics and physics and calculus and all these types of different fields. And so I know how to, you know, look up things and research things. And I had encountered certain books and different articles about nutrition. And I started looking in the medical literature. And, you know, I would find things on vitamin C and all sorts of things that were never talked about. So, I kind of knew there was some stuff going on behind the scenes that never made it out to the television or newspapers or anything, which I thought was kind of. So by the time this came up, I was like, well, I don't, you know, maybe it's just not talked about for some reason, so let me just go look it up. So I wouldn't really call it research at that point. But
Right.
after I did that chart, I decided, hey, you know, where did they get this data from? You know, is this data correct? And I happened to be living near Yale Medical Library down in New Haven. So I decided, you know, what the heck? I'm just going to show up and use the library. I don't belong to Yale, but you know, we'll see what happens. I'll just pretend like I belong there. And so I
Right.
showed up, and there was a guard there. He's like, oh, what are you here for? I'm here to use the library. Okay, fill out this form. Here you go. Here's a sticker for your chest to stick on you that you're a visitor. I'm like, okay. So I just walked
Cool.
in like I own the place, and I found the United States Vital Statistics books. They were just these big green books at the time. Everything wasn't online at that point. So I just started paging through them, and I found mortality statistics from like 1932 to 1935. Oh, okay. You'd have to photocopy that. So I would photocopy that, and I'd go through all these books until I had everything from 1900 to, I don't know, 1970 or whatever it was. And after I had all that stuff all photocopied, because, you know, you couldn't just get all the years in one book. You had to go through all these books. I,
Right.
um,
Was this
you know,
multiple days, or you were able to do this in one day?
I took a couple of trips, I think, as I recall,
Okay.
because there was, you know, it's not like it's just easy to find. You'd have to go through lots and
Right.
lots of stuff.
Yeah.
I finally got back, and we had spreadsheets, so I started putting it in the spreadsheet. And after a while, you know, I get all the data in there, which takes a long time because you're doing it manually, you're not scanning it or anything. And so I had photocopied things for measles, whooping cough, and you know, a couple other diseases, because they were all on the same page, right? So I entered them all in the spreadsheet. And so I charted the measles, and I was like, wow, it's actually a decline of 98% before they came out with the vaccine. So that was, you know, that was confirmed evidence that this was actually true, because this is the source material. You couldn't get anything better than that.
Right.
And then I noticed, hey, the same thing is true for whooping cough. Whooping cough had declined by over 92% before the vaccine. I was like, oh, wow, that's crazy. That's true for that too. And I noticed all the infectious diseases from 1900 into the 1960s had all just plummeted, and they all declined,
Right.
which I thought was really interesting. But was, you know, what really hit me was, well, how come we don't know this?
Exactly.
Shouldn't and then what caused that massive decline before vaccinations? And why do we all think it's just the vaccine? It just didn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, I mean, I
And
have two quick notes. It is amazing that given that you could just, as a sort of commoner, go into the libraries, find the data yourself, and put it together, it's amazing that so many people who are professionals in the industry could all just accept without question the fact that the idea that it was vaccines that was the solution to these issues, when so
Well,
clearly the data says that that's not true. And it's amazing how this sort of belief system can perpetuate with, I guess, nobody checking the facts.
but I think part of that is the people who wrote studies, and honestly, I don't know what their motivation was. They could have been they could have made a mistake. They could have been biased for vaccines because they work for a manufacturer, or I don't know why it occurred, but if, when you look at
Right.
their medical literature, for example, pediatrics, it was a big report in pediatrics in 1988. And I got that report, and they reference a historical mortality from colonial times to whatever, I can't remember exactly. But in there, you could take the same data points that I had already recovered and chart them. But so it was basically the same data set. There was a little variations, but it was basically the same. But what
Right.
they wrote in their article, the first paragraph was, and this was all true. This is all true what they said. They said 5 to 10,000 people used to die from whooping cough, but today only 5 to 10 die. And they go, well, that's thanks to vaccination. Well, that part is false, because they already had a 92% decline. And if you look at the trend was unaffected by the vaccination. It's crystal clear. So they either missed it or they purposely misrepresented it. I don't know. Either way, the whole paper, which is, I can't remember how many pages it was, but quite a long article, is worthless because their opening paragraph is wrong.
Right.
They should have said, hey, there was a decline in mortality and vaccinations really didn't have much of an impact. But for whatever reason, they did not write that. I don't know these people, don't know their motivations. I can't speak to why, but it was a complete, you know.
Well, I was just going to say, it seems that, actually, this is one of the things I discovered before I got into the details about the vaccine industry, was the sort of discovery that the medical journals have been sort of captured and gone in a very corrupt direction for a long period of time. And a lot of people assume that these are like sacrosanct journals in terms of scientific integrity, but they're really not in terms of how they're fact-checked and peer-reviewed. I mean,
right. So these are peer-reviewed. You know, again, I don't know if it was just a mistake. It seems highly unlikely that multiple authors wouldn't have noticed that, or they just weren't interested in pointing that out, which sounds probably more probable. Or some editor came along and said, no, we got to get rid of that part. I don't know. But the end result was that it misrepresented what was going on with whooping cough, and grossly misrepresented it. And because of that, you have thousands, if not tens of thousands or more people reading this article, if you're a pediatrician, going, wow, thank goodness we have vaccination. Otherwise, we would have 5,000 to 10,000 deaths every year.
Right.
So because of that error or purposeful intent, which I don't know, you perpetuate this mythology, widespread, and who's going to blame a doctor for believing what they read in a medical journal that says 5,000 to 10,000 people would be dying now if we didn't have the vaccine, which is, again, not true. So, when people write these, studies, they can cause a whole lot of damage if they misrepresent information. And that's what occurred here. And by the way, it was very hard to find studies that look at data, which I thought was kind of interesting. But so doctors and anybody reading these journals, which would be mostly doctors, except for crazy people like me, would be, they would be convinced of vaccination, and who would blame them? It makes sense. Yeah, it's like, well, this I read it in the journal. Look at that. Wow, that's impressive. And I read this.
Well, basically, the whole industry is built on articles like this, because that becomes their basis for claiming that the products that they're selling are absolutely vital to.
I don't know who these people are. Did they work for vaccine companies? Do they have biased interests? Or I don't know. I mean, somebody else could look into that. And I would hope that it would be really nice if some of these people that were in charge of these papers came out and came clean. That would be nice. There's always hoping. But, this is why we have this mythology about vaccination, that it's like the greatest thing ever, when that's not what the data shows. I mean, there's no other way to look at the data. And I was also later on very fortunate. I was able to get data from England, Wales, and that they started gathering data in 1838. That's when they started gathering national mortality statistics. So that's quite a few years before 1900. Right. And there was pieces missing in there I had to get from other documents, but you could see that during the 1800s, measles, scarlet fever, whooping cough, smallpox, these are all big killers. But starting basically in the later 1800s, they all started to go down, all of them. They all went down, 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 down. And if you looked at, for example, just measles from the peak of 70, you normalize it to how many people die per 100,000. So that accounts for population. So they went from a peak of like 70 per 100,000 to 0.1 per 100,000, which is a 99.8% decline from that peak. So it was a massive decline before they started vaccinating in 1968. So, you know, if you have that big of a decline, you would go, well, I think we're pretty much done. We don't need to do anything else. Right. Mm-hmm. A normal person would have said, hey, we already have the problem basically solved. Why don't we just kind of focus on the last 0.1%, 0.1 deaths per 100,000? Maybe it was 0.2. I can't recall. But it was very low. Right. Same thing with whooping cough. That declined by 99 points. I can't recall. 0.4% before the vaccine. So these are not tiny declines. They're significant. Problem is right. Solved with lines, but you wouldn't know that from the medical professionals because they don't know. And I don't blame them for not knowing because the medical literature was telling them something else.
Right.
So then you get locked into that belief system and, you know, and a lot of us did. And Suzanne was in that, you know, Dr. Humphrey, Suzanne, she's, by the way, she's brilliant and one of the nicest, and she has like complete integrity. She just doesn't lie about anything. She's just such a truth teller. So she's fabulous, by the way. Anyway,
yeah,
she believed. She believed in vaccines too. I mean, why wouldn't you? Until you know, she had her incidents in the hospital that she's talked about, and then she started looking. It's like, wow, what the heck? And other doctors who have actually looked find the same thing. And I mean, the data is clear as day. And another interesting thing is, it's not like the data wasn't known. So if you looked at, and I only recently found this, and actually I didn't find somebody pointed it out to me, I can't recall who, but there was a U.S. vital statistics issue in the late 60s or sometime in the 60s. And they had charts, just like I had charts for measles showing the 98% decline before any vaccine. Of course, up to 1960, there was no vaccine. So they showed this massive decline in death from that and typhoid and every other disease was just all plummeted.
Yeah.
And, you know, pre-1940, 50, they would remark in these journals that, yeah, wow, infectious diseases are not a big deal anymore. They used to be bad, but not anymore. We don't suspect they're going to be a big part of mortality anymore. You know, they were very happy with everything that's been changed with modern living, so they didn't have to worry about it anymore. But that changed, you know, starting in the 40s and 50s and 60s. They started like, well, let's create vaccines for these really non-issues at this point.
Right.
You know, and no one, as far as I know, no one looked at why there was a massive decline and said, hey, let's focus on why things changed. As
right.
far as I know, no one ever looked.
Interesting, because we're kind of building a story or a narrative here that is challenging the idea basically of looking at one a sickness as one being caused by one single thing, which is kind of a mindset that I think that a lot of medical professionals are indoctrinated to, maybe through how they're going to school, but it's like sickness is the cause of one thing. And this story that you're telling about the declines before the vaccines, and vaccines are designed to treat this sort of like one cause, you know, one sickness, one cause, one
well,
term kind of idea.
Yeah.
But the case we're building is that, you know, the causes of disease are actually, you know, complex or dynamic, and you need to have some idea about social context that's happening, living improvements and things like that. And, you know, your average medical professional is not trained to think in those types of
well, yeah, that's true. So, you know, once I had the decline in mortality, of course, the next question is why, right? And so you start, you know, reading the 1800s medical literature and history documents, and that's another kind of thing that kind of blew my mind, how life in the 1800s was, you know, dreadful.
Right.
It was a lot of, you know, some people lived quite well, but a lot of people were poor. They worked ridiculous numbers of hours. There was no sanitation. There was no concept of hygiene.
Right.
Nutrition was horrible. So if you were in the
yeah.
city, you know, where did you get your food? You know, people would bring the cows into the city and slaughter them, and they would hang the meat in the windows. And, you know, and it would sit there for days rotting away, and you would eat that.
The water was really bad.
Well, yeah, since there was no, toilets, basically you went to the bathroom and out the window it went, and, you know, it would rain, it would go into your water supply. You were all drinking from this horrible, contaminated stuff. You wouldn't even call it water. And of course, industries were there, tanneries and all sorts of industries. They're all dumping their toxins in there. And so your food was all contaminated and adulterated, and you were stressed out. You were working like crazy, and children were working. There were no child labor laws, so you had kids as young as 4 years old working in mines. And you know, when they got sick, you know what's going to happen? You're malnourished, you're overworked. You know, you're going to get sick and die. Anybody would, right? And then it all slowly changed as reformers, you know, a lot of people worked on this. I mean, millions of people over many decades put in, you know, piped water. We had innovations of electricity, which then eventually ended up with the ice box and eventually refrigerators. Transportation improved. Nutrition improved. People started eating more fruits and vegetables. And not just eating rotten meat and refined carbs. And so, and then labor laws got put in. So children were no longer working in factories. You know, you have a bunch of children's, you know, malnourished children working in a factory. What do you think is going to happen? It's going to be a disaster.
Yeah.
So these things started shifting, and as well as chlorination of water supplies that were, you know, rather filthy, and filtration systems and all sorts of innovations. And all these things came in all basically at the same time. And over the decade, you can see the mortality rate from all these, you know, so-called infectious diseases going down, 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 down. And so then you go, well, it can't be an infectious disease, just a microbe by itself causing a disease. Otherwise, it still would have been killing the same number of people in the 1950s and 1960s, right?
Yeah.
But it wasn't. So it can't, the microbe theory, because there's two competing theories, there's germ theory versus terrain theory. And germ theory is like you're just a hapless human and you encounter a germ and then you're sick and then maybe you're dead. The terrain theory is more, you know, what's the health of the society, health of the host. That's what's really important. And these charts and the historical information prove that terrain theory is more, you know, in line with reality as opposed to germ theory. Germ theory is false. It's not real. But this is the kind of theory we're stuck with because of misrepresentations and ignoring historical data.
And you have this multi-billion dollar industry entirely built on the premise of it.
Right. I think that kind of grew up around this whole concept. And, you know, who knows, you know, sure, it fed back into the system like, hey, we're making money off these things. But it's also, I think it started out as just a false belief system in the late 1800s.
Right.
They got this newfangled, you know, device called a microscope. And they're like, well, why do people get sick? They looked under the microscope and it's like, oh, look at those things moving around. That's got to be the reason the person got sick. And they pretty much just stuck with that idea. And it was never really challenged. Well, there were people that challenged it, but they didn't win. And so we got stuck with this idea. And then, well, what are we going to do? We got to kill the microbe. How are we going to stop the microbe? Or how are we going to help the person defend against the microbe? And that's where you get this big flood of, you know, let's keep on doing these vaccine things and let's keep on, you know, coming up with drugs to kill the microbe, which, again, if we look at the data, it shows that that is a false reality that's unfortunately we're still stuck with.
Yeah. So basically we're looking at the birth of an industry coming at the same time that these other transformations are taking place in society, and somehow things get framed where all the credit goes to this sort of like newfound industry, and they get to claim an absolute victory over these health successes, and we seem to have taken for granted that all the other changes that took place around that same time.
Right. So yeah. So because of these publications, and because of you know, sure, there's industry money behind these things, but you know, it started with a belief system, and you know, all the money supports this belief system, and it just grows up around it, and we're stuck with this stuff today, thinking that you know that the word vaccine, which is really just a brand name, right? Every injection is a little different, but it all has the same name.
Right.
It's created this magical aura around the word vaccine. So pretty much anything that's labeled as a vaccine is automatically believed to be, you know, something that wipes out disease and saves the day, right?
Right.
And that's where we are today. The magic is still there. The magic word is still there. And, you know, it's caused a lot of problems. And it didn't need to be that way, but that's where we are now.
Yeah. The it's interesting going back to the terrain theory versus the germ theory. It's you know, kind of from what I've been able to gather, there's been a kind of similar trend in almost all the different scientific fields, where on one hand you have a group of people who are trying to take a more holistic view of whatever topic they're looking at, like a dynamic kind of almost like a systems view. And then you have another group, which is really has become the orthodox group, and that's one characterized by the sort of ideology of scientific materialism, and like you're always looking for the material, single material cause of things rather than the sort of dynamic approach. So in one hand, it makes sense to me from a historical perspective how this movement could have taken hold in medicine, because in a lot of ways it. A similar movement took place almost all over society in different realms.
Yeah, it's happened throughout history. I mean, one of the classic examples is the Earth is the center of the universe, right? And that was strongly believed. And you know, if you challenge that and said, "Hey, no, I think the sun's in the middle," you know, you were it was not received too well. You were a heretic. And
right.
I think we're basically in the same kind of boat with this germ theory centric view of the universe, which is a nice simple model, but it's not reality. And you know, it's hard to escape a belief system, because
right.
You know, if you go actually look, and you're actually willing to look, and you're willing to challenge a belief system, and the few that do and look at it, they break out of it. But how many people actually look? Because, you know, people are busy, they already have, you know, their minds made up, and so it's hard to get anybody to go look at something in a different way. But
yeah.
I'm hopeful that over time, and other people have been hopeful over the many, many, many decades, that things would change. And so I'm hopeful that now that some more people will look at that and go, "Oh, we got that wrong. Maybe we have to rethink things." That speaks also to another human weakness. Of course, I'm a human too. But when people find out that they might be wrong about something, they get very, very defensive. They get very upset and don't like to analyze anything they might be wrong about. Because I don't know exactly why this occurs, but instead of looking at something like, "Oh, that's new information I didn't know," it's almost like a psychological blow. And, you know, and I experienced some of that. It's like, "Oh, I was wrong. How could I be wrong? How could I not know?" Right. And so I think because we get stuck in this "I can't be wrong" attitude, things don't tend to change, because especially if you put a lot of emotional investment in it. So let's say, you know, you're somebody who's a doctor or just a regular old person, and you're strongly pro-vaccine, and you're yelling at people and calling them names. And then are you going to go look at something that challenges that? Probably not, because you don't want to be wrong. You already have your ideology. And that's a big problem to overcome.
Right. There's a So far we've been talking about kind of the early years of vaccines and the industry and the sort of claim successes. And then if we move things up a little bit, going now more towards the mid-20th century, around the years of World War II, you have this sort of giant chemical sort of industrial combine that develops alongside the war. And then this combine makes chemical products. I mean, they were making bombs, but they make basically, they make chemicals. That's their specialty. So after the war, these industries, which are very had grown a lot and were very influential, decided to sort of pivot and keep making the same chemicals, but find new uses for them. So you have, new types of fertilizers and pesticides and things being used. And so I'm bringing this up because I was hoping to transition now to talk about the case of polio. Is that one of the ones you all covered in the book, or is that something you?
Yeah, that was
case that you've been familiar with.
Right, that's Suzanne's baby more than mine. But polio is interesting because it was never a high incidence disease. It was pretty low compared to measles or syphilis or anything like that, or even malaria. It just wasn't. We have a chart based on, and again, the vital statistics, and it's a very low incidence disease. But I think it came at the time where, there was a lot of mass media where they could kind of emphasize certain things going on. And polio is kind of a complicated thing. It was eventually declared to be a, single thing that's causing it. But I think ultimately it was multifactorial. And some of it was, exposure to toxins. I think DDT was, had a play in there. And other chemicals, which I can't remember the name.
Yeah, I was going to say the DDT connection seems like it was one of those main ones, because from the history that a lot of the early breakouts were in these regions where these sort of pesticides are being sprayed, and it looks like the point you were just making about polio having different potential causes behind it is that it seems that different things can cause you to demonstrate the symptoms of having polio. Rather than, I think a lot of people assume that polio is something you can take a test for, and it's like, oh, we found polio in your system. But actually, polio seems to be diagnosed in terms of you're demonstrating symptoms that appear like polio.
Yeah, and some of it was the treatment. If you take, we know this now. So if you take somebody who's having some kind of problem, and you immobilize their leg for, a year, and then you take off the brace, what do you think is going to happen? Their leg's atrophied. It's not going to work. So they were doing that, and it was, a disaster. But, you had somebody like Sister Kenny, and actually they made a movie. I never actually saw the movie, but they made a movie about her. She treated people for polio using massage and hot packs, and she didn't have any problems. They all recovered. It was basically the medical model of, the way they treated things, which still persists today. There's a lot of things that go wrong, but they're basically kind of just, swept under the rug and they move on. And even the last 20 years, if you look at various studies in JAMA, Journal of the American Medical Association, British Medical Journal, Journal of Patient Safety, and others, and they show that in these articles, between 225,000 and maybe 400,000 more people die every year because of the medical system. I mean, that's huge.
Yeah.
It's the third leading cause of death.
Disgusting.
And it's always ignored. It's ignored. Nothing ever changes. So it's been over 20 years. I think there was something earlier than that, too, Shank, showing similar thing. But those are always ignored because, who wants to? As an industry, there's no incentive to fix it. I'm not saying your average doctor is like, well, who cares if they die, right? But as a whole industry, it's not something anybody's interested in fixing. They don't track any kind of medical error in their database. It's like, oh, okay, the person died from this, but maybe it was in part due to medical error. or there's no database for, you know, drug problems. If you take a drug and then you get sick and die from the drug, well, that's not recorded either. So, you know, we're not really interested in the problems that are occurring. So we have this kind of fake system in the front of everything, like, oh, we tested these drugs. And if there's enough reporting, then maybe we'll put a black box on it. And if it gets really bad, maybe the company will, you know, get sued a little bit, like as in Vioxx. And but basically, the system continues, trucking along, because the system itself is not going to say, "Hey, we have a big problem here. A lot of people are dying because of our system. We need to fix it." And that just doesn't happen.
I think everything you're saying is just kind of proving it very well. The idea that, you know, the medical research and the medical system, the policies and everything that we have are not, it's not clean science. It's not like these campaigns and these policy decisions and these medical solutions that we're given, they're not formulated under a neutral scientific environment and then given out sort of like
right.
by these
right.
benefactors. Like the whole thing is structured as an industry, as a profit-making industry that sort
Correct.
Of cornered the whole aspect in terms of regulations, in terms of the policy making, in terms of they basically regulate themselves. And so
back in the 60s we spent about 5% of our GDP on medical care. Now it's 20%. It's a huge profit making system, and when these big corporations they're making a lot of money, they want to keep making money, and so they have influence on politicians, just like the oil industries are. The plastic industry is basically the same petrochemical industry, or the military industrial complex. You know, they all have vested interests in doing certain things that keeps them going. So in the case of the military, they want to keep wars going. You know, we were in Afghanistan for 20 years for no reason, really.
Right.
So, you know, people made a lot of money, you know, and it's the same thing with the, you know, you can call it the medical industrial complex, right? So they're making lots of money. There's no incentive to fix problems, not really. And, you know, they're not going to have a big campaign saying, hey, you know, 200,000 to 300,000 people died last year from the medical system. You know, we got to fix that. Now, who's going to put that on TV? What politician is going to talk about that? None of them. And so the
right.
problem persists because there's no one wants to, you know, shine a light on that. Well, that I shouldn't say no one, because there, you know, there's been articles. The British Medical Journal had a really good article not that long ago about it. But, you know, as an industry, there's just no interest in doing it. And same thing with vaccine reactions. It's a voluntary system. The BEARS vaccine adverse event reporting system is voluntary. So they're only
right.
capturing maybe 1, 5, 10% of the actual problems to be reviewed. And that's not acceptable. It should be a mandatory system. If you're going to force people to take something, it should be a mandatory system to, you know, track all these problems. And it's just not done. And so you have this, you know, it's just a broken system.
Completely agreed. I want to return just for a second back to the polio situation. I think that's an illustrative case study, because not only does the conclusion that, even though we were saying that polio is something that could be caused by a lot of things, including by toxicity poisoning from industrial waste products or fertilizers or whatever, but
mm-hmm.
if we can say that polio is actually only caused by a sort of viral contagion, then not only do you seed the environment for an industry to be created to create that solution, that vaccine, but you can also shield the original companies who could be very liable for making these harmful toxins and fertilizers and putting them in an environment. You know, there's a shield there, a legal shield for those companies. And because the possible sort of like correlation between the two is shattered, because the sort of official explanation becomes, well, polio is not caused by toxic poisoning. It's only caused by this virus. If that makes sense. I
Yeah,
think that's another incentive playing into the situation.
it also feeds into the single problem, single solution, simplistic model. It's basically like a 5-year-old model of reality. It's like, oh, I have one problem, here's my solution, done. It's a very emotionally satisfying and simplistic way to look at things. And that's what we've been doing for quite a long time. Oh, you have problem X, your cholesterol's high, we got to lower your cholesterol, here's the solution. And these are not really the correct solutions for these problems. It's not a holistic solution looking at, all the different factors.
Is AIDS, have you followed the sort of story with sort of how the AIDS diagnosis and the AIDS sort of treatments? I know it doesn't specifically have to do with vaccines, but it does actually, it seems from what I've read about it, it has a similar plot line to this polio situation in terms of AIDS being said that it's something that's only caused by this one thing, when in reality, AIDS seems to be a set of symptoms that you have that can be caused by different factors.
Robert Bernstein, I think it was, a number of years ago, Rethinking AIDS, I think it was called. Really technical book, really, really interesting. But I think generally, when this first started out, there was a group of people that had, sick, didn't know what it was. And it turns out they were doing a lot of these party drugs, ammonium nitrates, if that's incorrect.
So let me just recap a little bit about what you're saying. You can fill in for the part that cut out. But we're talking about AIDS, and there was a sort of you said there's a book called Rethinking AIDS, where the sort of theory came out that one of the causes of the sort of sickness that was going on in the gay in certain gay communities that was being attributed to this growth and spread of this AIDS virus actually had to do with the type of drug that was being commonly used in those circles. Is that correct?
Right. So that was one thing. That was one thing that was involved, especially in the initial cases. Which is a ammonium nitrate. And probably said that incorrectly. But that suppresses your immune system. There were other factors too that causes immune suppression to some extent. And all these things kind of got basically sidelined and replaced by, hey, we found a virus, a retrovirus. And that was the answer, is a single cause, single solution kind of thing again. And they did start with AZT, which was a toxic drug, and they did some initial trials apparently, which I think went fairly well. So they said, okay, that's what we're going to do. But long-term use of that stuff was toxic and seems to have killed quite a few people until they finally stopped it after 4 years, I think. So this was just a another disaster based on, jumping to conclusions or creating the mythology of the virus. And, the medical system's obsessed with a virus, bacteria or some kind of microbe is causing the problem, when really it's usually something completely different. I didn't really write about this, so I'm probably not, shouldn't be speaking too much about it, but from what I understand, there's multiple different conditions that all got dropped under this immunosuppressive kind of umbrella. So there were things that were already there, but they all got put under this umbrella of immune suppression.
That's the impression I get, and I feel the same general story line is also true of the autism situation. Have you found anything about that?
Well, I think you can cause those kind of problems with any kind of number of toxins. So I've talked to quite a few parents and because what I wrote, and you go to these events and parents come up to you and they tell me, my kid got a vaccine because it's why they're usually there, and right after that, boom, they just deteriorated. And not only do they have that disaster, but if they ever bring up that they think it was a vaccine, they're attacked and lambasted and called all sorts of names and even accused of actually causing the damage themselves. And it's all horrible things, instead of listening, considering what they've gone through. But I think there's lots of different causes. It's not
it's not just one thing, so it's not easy to pinpoint. And there were early cases of neurological damage, for example, with the whooping cough vaccine. I think it was in must have I think it was in the New England Journal of Medicine, but I don't recall right now. And they had a bunch of cases they looked at, and they showed that these kids were developing normally, and they ended up with neurological problems and regressed. And this was talked about, I think it was in the late 40s. They just kind of nothing really happened with it. So I think these things, when you put toxins into a human body, you can cause, a variety of different kinds of damage. But it could also come from something else, some other toxic exposures. And I don't know if anybody really knows all the different, factors. So I haven't really followed a lot of that, certainly not recently.
It's a dark topic overall, and it's really just sad and infuriating the way things have played out. So, one of the important areas in this sort of issue or sort of this framing of sort of germ theory and the sort of vaccines as a solution campaign is to sort of make claims that viruses have been isolated and purified and determined definitively using microscopes and lab tests that they can take a sick person and show that they have the virus. But it seems like in each case, that's never actually been true. Is that a side of the story that you've gone into in terms of the methodology issues in terms of how viruses are established as being isolated or purified or whatever?
When this whole situation originally started, and and I heard about this happening, I'm like, well, this can't be that serious because I knew all infectious disease rates, they all declined. As long as you have a healthy population, no big deal. This something's wrong with this story. But then at the time, I thought, well, our obesity rate is going through the roof, not just in the United States, but globally. So that's certainly a big problem causing, issues, as well as people being more sedentary and not being outside and getting sunshine with adequate. So I thought, well, okay, well, all these unhealthy people, which the data shows were the ones getting hit the hardest, that's the problem. And there's probably some microbe that, is taking the full blame for it, but I kind of assumed there was some kind of, new virus or something like that. But over time, as I started, reading some more stuff and talking to a few different people, different doctors, I started going, well, how do they know it's a virus? How did they figure this out? And I started looking into the PCR test and how they seeded the RNA sequences into that PCR test. And it turned out it was only a fragment obtained from this is my understanding, from a single patient that they assembled the computer. And it's like, here's a fragment, and we found a new virus from a bunch of, from a single patient. And patients were always dying in Wuhan from the environment that was highly polluted. So it was nothing surprising, but somebody decided to, hey, let's look for, something new, even though there were no novel symptoms, right? And so they take this fragment that was assembled by a computer and go, hey, we found something because it kind of matches another one that we had before. So it must be a new virus. And so they wrote up a report, and it got passed, in I think one day. Basically, that's not really peer reviewing if you pass it in one day. And it became like, oh, okay, let's start testing for it. What is that RNA fragment? As far as I know, the virus has not been really isolated, where you just have a virus, which is supposed to be a protein coat and all this genetic material on the inside, right? No one's ever really just isolated just the virus. And obviously, that's a problem because now you can't confirm that RNA sequence is part of that virus if you haven't done that. And instead, we just decided that this particular test defines if you have an illness. And that doesn't make any sense to me
It
whatsoever.
says on the test that the packet of the test, if I'm not wrong, that this cannot be used for a diagnostic use.
Well, that might be true.
Diagnose, you know, it's not even meant for that.
Yeah, well, yeah, I don't think you use a, I don't think this has ever happened before where you're using a single test to diagnose an illness. You usually have to have clinical symptoms, but suddenly that's not true. And it's almost like a mania that has swept the entire globe saying, hey, we have a test, therefore you're sick. Well, I don't feel sick. Well, you must be asymptomatic. Well, okay, how would you know that? Because this test said so. I mean, that's not how you're supposed to actually prove, you know, a problem. You're supposed to isolate the microbe. You're supposed to find it in large amounts in a person, that microbe, and then you're supposed to take that microbe and see if you can infect another, you know, entity with that particular microbe and see if they get the same symptoms. None of that's been done. It's been assumed that, gee, we have this RNA sequence, therefore you have something. And that just doesn't make any sense to me at all. And there's quite a few doctors that have looked at that, and they're like, that doesn't make any sense either. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. But it's taken hold, and now everyone believes the test. And I think that's just a completely wrong-headed way to look at it. And, you know, this single test has caused mayhem across the planet because there's other problems with it too. It depends on your cycle count, you know, how much right. you replicate whatever you're looking at. And if you're, you know, replicating 25 at a level 25, that's one thing. If you're doing it 37 or 40 or 45, which is, I think 45 is the current standard, it's complete nonsense. You're finding maybe a signal of something. It just doesn't, none of it makes any sense at all, but we're all doing it. So it's almost like some kind of mass mania. That's
absolutely, yeah. It definitely is a type of mass psychosis. But right. It's amazing the power that people, that the sort of white lab coat and the sort of like complicated jargon and the sort of just numbers, and people have this idea that, oh, if there's numbers, if there's data, then it's got to be true. If there's people with white lab coats saying it, then it has to be right. How could it possibly be wrong? You know?
Yeah, there's it's a very cultish behavior, and using magic words like science. You know, science is a process. It's not like an end result. It's like, oh, we're following the science. What does that mean? I mean, there's plenty of times when you know, scientists later found out that they were wrong, but for some reason, in this last 18, almost 2 years now, you know, science means being absolutely 100% right. And if anybody disagrees with the science, then you must be flogged in the public square. And,
yeah, exactly.
And it's you know, it's crazy. No, science doesn't work that way. You could be working on something and then, you know, years later find out it's not correct. But for some reason, you know, people have taken hold of that this is, you know, reality. And I don't think it's reality at all. I just don't think there's any real major problem. And even using, you know, these statistics, kids and young adults or up to like 30 were not really affected by this at all. But still, there's this mania that everybody has to be protected. Well, that's crazy. I mean, these people were not being affected at all. They weren't dropping in the
yeah,
street. Or
they're not really in danger in any serious no. way. And you, so I want to just rewind for a second, because I think you make a very good point, and this is something that I've thought about a lot, which is that the way people are treating what science is when they're saying I trust the science is exactly backwards, because they're treating science almost like a religion in the way that they're treating it as a set of ideas or like as a dogma. It's this science is this set of ideas that I was taught in school, and that's what science is. But actually, science is a process. And
it's a
the
process.
Ideas are constantly coming, or it's like creative destruction is constantly happening in terms of the theories and ideas. So at any one time, the ideas of science can are subject to change, but the process is what you commit to with science. The science is that process, but people are treating it in a completely opposite way. So it infuriates me for people to be saying, I trust the science and stuff like that, the scientists or whatever, and it's like, you don't even know what you're talking about. In terms of what science is.
one thing I've found out over the years when I'm doing any kind of research, if you want to really know something, you have to spend years to really understand something. You know, watching some couple people on TV tell you something is true, you're not going to get the truth. You need to really dig into things, and that doesn't happen a lot because people are busy. They want to believe people in charge or actually have their best interests in mind, and it just ripples from there. I think a society of real critical thinkers wouldn't have fallen for this, but and there's a lot of people that haven't fallen for this, but they're marginalized, and there's people in power for whatever reason, profits or just ideology. And I think a lot of it's built up on this vaccine mythology, that if vaccines saved us from everything else, why isn't it going to save us from this, right? So it's all built on all this, you know, really non-science kind of stuff, you know, belief systems. It's all built on, you know, it's very cultish behavior, like I was saying. It's like, well, we believe they're true, and therefore it must be true.
Right.
But if it's not,
one thing
can't be true because they said it on TV, so it must be true.
Right. I was going to say another thing kind of related to the same topic of sort of the misuse of science is the way that people are still thinking or trying to argue that sort of early treatments or at-home treatments for COVID as a means of recovery so you don't get really sick, that those are just hypothetical or speculative. That's a rejection of science, which is like, well, let's go actually look. And if you look, there are so many people, millions probably, who have had success using a variety of these treatments. But in the public sphere, it's treated as if it's only speculative, as if nobody has used these to success, you know?
Well, I think we got to go back to the fundamental problem is no one has a particular condition. What they have is a test that says you have a positive with an unknown cycle count testing an
right.
RNA fragment that has never been proven to be part of a pathogen. Yeah, it's not part
right.
of a virus, right? So what are you really trying to fix when you don't even know what the real problem is? And I think certain things are going to be helpful automatically because they're helping your whole system, your whole health, you know, like zinc and quercetin, things of that nature, and even some of these older drugs that might be doing something beneficial that has really nothing to do with your PCR unknown cycle count positive test. So I think, you know, anything that's, you know, of benefit is probably incidental to, you know, having a real viral problem. Or, you know,
right.
who knows what's really going on. And I have to say, and which I don't think you'll ever hear a public official ever say, oh, I could be wrong. You know, this could be, maybe I'm mistaken. Maybe what we're looking at, somehow we missed something. And if there is a fully isolated virus with the whole genome and this RNA fragment has been matched to that, I'd like to see that. I mean, I haven't seen it. I've seen lawsuits come out saying, hey, you know, where's your proof that there's an actual virus? And no one's been able to produce it as far as I know, but I could be wrong. Maybe it does exist somewhere and I missed the boat, and I would like to be pointed out where that might be. But as far as I know, it's not been published in any journal where this whole genetic sequence has been mapped out and you know, has the thing that's been isolated and who has replicated your results. Right? Some other independent scientists have to replicate what you, that's part of science. You have to be able to replicate your experiment. Someone should be able to take, you know, isolate the virus using the same techniques and get the same genetic sequences. But if they're just using the PCR test, then you haven't done anything. You're still doing the same thing.
Yeah.
And there was a paper not that long ago showing how people who try to replicate lots of different studies were not able to replicate studies. You know, I don't recall which studies they were doing, but you know, there was a high failure rate in trying to replicate these studies that were supposedly like sacrosanct, right? And people couldn't replicate them. So, you know, that's a problem. If you can't replicate a study, then what good is the study? So in the case of this, virus, you need to be able to have independent groups isolate it. You have to be able to, you know, do the same process and then, you know, extract the RNA out of the virus. If you can't do that, then you haven't proven anything. And like I said, you know, maybe that exists, and, you know, I don't know everything. I'm not privy to everything, and neither are all the people I work with, but as far as I know, that does not exist.
Yeah, I mean, it's a consequence of this sort of fixation on the germ or the virus as the cause, is that people don't get the proper treatment as if it was a more dynamic, holistic health issue, which we're both agreeing that illness and disease seems to be connected with this sort of dynamic state of the body, mm-hmm. and not just this sort of monocausal situation. But people, unfortunately, and I saw that first person with this coronavirus or COVID situation, because my roommate got sick. And, you know, so I got to see the official sort of response in terms of the care people that were coming to the house. And they don't give you anything to help you. They just tell you there's nothing they can do, you know, try to fight through it or whatever. And meanwhile, you hear of all these home treatments. I mean, I helped him recover eventually when I could convince him to go see my doctor, who I could see someone who is trained in traditional Chinese medicine. And she said that, and I have an interview with her on my channel, actually, but she was saying that she's been treating people all year using just the methods of Chinese medicine. And in Chinese medicine, it's very much terrain theory, because you're treating the symptoms by trying to reestablish equilibrium in their body.
Yeah.
That's what the orientation of the acupuncture and the herbs are. And she was saying in China, there's a very well-defined protocol for using traditional Chinese medicine to treat COVID, and it's been used in a widespread way. And we don't hear anything about that.
Right.
Like, people are shocked when I tell them that.
Well, you can look at even studies here, right? There's been a lot of studies done, and they show that obesity is a key factor. They show lack of exercise is a key factor. They showed early on that, you know, vitamin D cuts mortality rate in half, which would also reduce heart disease and cancer and stroke, by the way, because vitamin D is really, you know, more of a hormone than just a vitamin, and it's involved in like 5% of biological functions. So we could have done these things early on, saying, hey, we have a problem, which we kind of know anyway. You know, we have an obesity epidemic. We got to work on that. Even just exercising helps. You got to get out and get some sunshine and get into nature, eat healthy foods. You know, the same thing you would do for everything. And suddenly there wouldn't have been any problem whatsoever. Instead, we became, you know, we panicked and started testing and sort of freaking it out. And then because of our past history with the single problem, single solution, that's the first thing that everybody turned to, because vaccines are really the magic wand of the medical system. It's like, oh, we have a magic wand. We're going to fix everything with the magic wand. When in this case, there may not have been anything to fix in the first place, aside from, you know, general health problems that we have, which aren't going away. From what I understand, obesity has gone up, even in children. It's gone up dramatically, which, of course, has just made things worse for any kind of upper respiratory problem, cancer, heart disease, all these things. But that just doesn't seem to matter. We're all single focused on this one thing. All the health problems, whatever. Those just dropped off.
Yeah, I know. It's as if no one ever got sick from anything else ever after the past year.
By doing this, people stayed inside. They got less sunshine. They got less exercise. They gained weight. So overall, their health declined. But it didn't seem to matter, because we're all running around just worrying about a microbe.
And there was no mobilization for health, to like promote health or anything during this time. You know, like you would even see the opposite in terms of free giveaways, like free donuts or something if you get a vaccine or whatever, different promotions.
Yeah. So, you know, in my opinion, we've been doing everything wrong since the 40s. Well, that's not true. So we started this process in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. I think our health peaked around somewhere in the 70s, and it's been going downhill ever since. Obesity has gone up. Sedentary lifestyle has gone up. People are not out in the sunshine, because I know people that are deadly afraid of getting out in the sun at all, because they're going to die from skin cancer. So their vitamin D levels are like probably near zero. So, because they're totally afraid of the sun, so they won't even go out in the sun. It's like a, a craziness. So, we have a lot of people that are deficient in that vital nutrient. And we also know people are deficient in, magnesium, for example, because of our industrial agriculture. So we've done a lot of things wrong by this whole stay at home, watch television, play games, eat lots of junk food, and everything will be fine.
Right.
This is not a strategy for a healthy society. So I think we've totally gone the wrong direction since really around 1980. Things have really just gone the wrong way as far as health goes. We could be doing much, much better. We should be doing much, much better. And a lot of it's all about personal responsibility, personal action.
Right.
No one overweight is a bad person, right? That doesn't mean you're a bad person or a horrible person or an ugly person. It means that
Right.
you are at risk for other health conditions. So you, it's not, you're welcome to, get really obese or morbidly obese, but you're going to be in trouble. It's not going to be good for you. And you should choose to, exercise and eat correctly, and you're going to feel better and you're going to, be healthier. And then getting people out in nature instead of just stuck on their televisions and cell phones and computers. These are all good things that would improve our society tremendously, but it's all kind of a personal responsibility thing. It's not a magic pill. It's like you can't go to the doctor and he's going to give you a magic pill. Everyone needs to go work on these things. And not only will you get healthier, you'll be happier, you'll be more centered. And it will, it'll make the planet a better place. Social connections are very important for depression, right? Because one of the studies I read, 20% of the people that were admitted to hospital suffered from anxiety and what was the other term? Anxiety and depressive conditions. That's a huge amount. I wonder how they got depressed and anxious.
Right.
I don't know how that could have happened. So we caused a lot of the problems ourselves by scaring people instead of telling
Right.
them, have good social connections, actually interact with people, Don't isolate, don't get yourself depressed. Depressed people aren't going to be healthy.
Yeah,
So
it's sort of one of the themes that I think is playing out here is this idea, and hopefully this will be one of the lessons learned whenever we get to the other side of this, is the idea that you can outsource your health to an industry or to a
right.
doctor or whatever, and that it's not you that needs it, that's responsible for upkeeping your own health. But
Right.
everything
That's
that you're saying is saying we need to shift our attitude towards like personal self-responsibility in terms of one's own health.
the medical system is way overly used. And I know people, they cough or they get a kind of bump, they run to the doctor. This is
Right.
not a good idea. A better idea is so you know how to take care of yourself. You don't feel so well, make some soup, take some garlic, all these kind of traditional, grandma kind of medicine. Maybe it's great grandma medicines, but and then you're fine like 99.9% of the time if you're doing these things, and then you use the medical system if you have a car accident. We
Right.
shouldn't be using it for all these things. And if we were a healthy society and people were fit, then heart disease would go down, cancer would go down, stroke would go down, diabetes would go down. All these things would just kind of slowly go away. And of course, cancers, you have toxins in the environment, but if we started eating all organic foods and got rid of all this, synthetic junk, everything would just shift. We would have a huge new health revolution like we had in the late 1800s that
Yeah.
transformed people into a healthy society instead of this society we're in currently.
And I mean, that's what I hope happens. But actually, this is a good transition point because last time we talked, you mentioned that you have an upcoming project built around environmental issues. And it seems that these environmental issues may necessitate these types of mass changes, whether we're gonna choose to do the health thing or not, we may be forced to because, as you were telling me, you're charting in this new book the sort of seriousness of the situation in terms of the environmental emergencies taking place.
Yeah, what we wrote about in the book is different things that are going on in the planet right now. They're all happening at the same time. They're very serious. They'll make COVID look like a kid's tea party. You know, we have plastics filling the oceans by 2050, up to 550 million cars worth. If you made a car into pure plastic and threw it in the ocean, you got 550 million of them in the ocean. It's fragmenting. So you're already breathing, eating, and drinking microplastics with all their associated toxins. It's through the entire environment. It's from the deep ocean to the Arctic. It's wafting through the air. It's everywhere. And we're only at the beginning of the tsunami. So that's one thing. It's destroying life in the oceans. The macroplastics are killing whales and everything else that accidentally eats it. So plastic is a huge, huge, gigantic environmental disaster just, you know, coming up. And it's just not changing direction. Another thing we're doing is we're sweeping the oceans for every living thing with giant trawlers that span the entire globe, scooping up everything. And by 2030, 2040, or 2050, there may be no more real fish in the ocean.
Mass for feeding people?
Yeah. So fish traditionally feed people, but now they not only trawl, they call it annihilation trawling, where they just scoop up everything and they just grind it up and they use it for fish meal to feed the chickens, or they use fish meal or make fish oil out of it, all these kinds of things. And there's really, it's gone wild. China actually travels to the west coast of Africa. You know, that's not really right next to China because there's still good fish stocks there. There's only, I think, like 7% of the world that's not overfished or at max. We're just basically wiping out the oceans. And, you know, if there's no fish by 2040 or 2050, that might be a problem. So we're wiping out the oceans. We're polluting them with plastic. Coral reefs have been declining for decades from toxins in the environment, sedimentation, industrialization, and throwing the oceans out of balance. So you have these corals going crazy, eating up the coral reefs. Surface sea temperatures have gone up, so this caused damage. So we've lost a lot of the coral reefs, and that's a huge amount of the environment, of the ocean environment, uses the coral reefs. So that's another disaster. Species are going extinct across the planet. Everything's going down. Rhinos used to be 850,000 of them. They're down to 5,000. Elephants are going down. Giraffes are going down. Lions, cheetahs. All the iconic animals are being wiped out. We're just hunting everything down. We're replacing it with, what we'd like to eat: cows, pigs, chickens, which are the predominant humans. Cows, pigs, and chickens are now the predominant life form on the planet as far as big animals. So 70% of the birds on the planet are domesticated. They're chickens, basically. And the rest, the 30% are wild. There's only 4%, I think it's 4% of the animals are wild anymore. Everything else is domesticated food sources and humans. You know, so we're wiping out the entire web of life on the planet. We're also cutting down all the rainforests. And the Amazon, which is the biggest rainforest on the planet, is at a tipping point where it will just collapse, because it needs all the trees in order to keep the moisture going through the system. So if the Amazon collapses, you'll have more of a look of South America that looks kind of like Australia, where it's all desert and scrub in the middle, instead of having a massive rainforest. That massive rainforest regulates temperatures and climate across the planet. Not to mention that keeps life sustained in South America. What happens if the Amazon collapses? For South America, they're going to be in, just a bit of trouble. So we have that going on. So you have all these different factors going on simultaneously. Right. And we're just not paying attention to them, not really. Glaciers are retreating across the planet. This is well studied and well documented. They're all retreating. Those are sources of fresh water. That's where a lot of people get their fresh water. Melting glaciers feed lots and lots of rivers, especially in Asia.
Right.
These glaciers are all retreating. You know, they're going to reach a point where they're not producing as much water anymore. That's our fresh water supply. You know, all these things are happening right now. I call it you know, how you go to Mars and you terraform it so that it becomes Earth-like. Well, we're de-terraforming the planet. We're making it less habitable for Earth by doing all the things we're doing. And it's not a smart way to do things. So we need to, you know, wake up to that. And as we were talking about, part of it is realizing what's important. You know, you can take care of your health. You don't need a giant medical industrial complex. We need to start working together in local communities, start growing gardens, going out and exercising, getting sunshine, and changing how we look at reality as you know, instead of just consumers. We waste huge amounts of food. Tons and tons of food every year is just thrown away because it doesn't look pretty enough, or, you know, because of transportation, or because we just don't care because it's not that much of our budget. We just throw it away. Huge. We could feed the hungry twice over with the food we throw out. Clothing.
Right.
We waste so much clothing. People buy clothing and they just hang it in their closet, or they just throw it away. It's disposable. That's another giant environmental disaster. And probably the third one is electronics. Electronics are in everything that they don't need to be in. Everything's electronics, and it just gets tossed, and it just ends up in a giant, you know, waste.
It's amazing we could have a society built around electronics with no, like, good system for recycling those, you know, ingredients back into a usable product, and it just all just gets goes to the third world, you know, developed countries, and these poor people are stuck with these environmental catastrophes with these e-waste dumps.
Right, e-waste. There was a big place, I forget the name of the place in China, district in China, where that was one of the things that, I don't know if they're doing it now, but that's one of the things they did. A bunch of poor people sat there with fires and other tools, extracted components where they could, melting plastics. The whole place is just a toxic dump. It's not sustainable. And, you know, there's all sorts of rare mineral metals in there that they could, you know, could reuse and stuff like that. But most of the things aren't recycled. They're just kind of tossed in a big pile. And, you know, you can only do that for so long before, you know, you have another thing on your hands. And you brought up a good point. The West, you know, using that term, you know, the United States and all the other Western countries, use the poor countries to get what they want. So there's plenty of Thai fishermen that are slaves basically on these boats. They have no freedom, and they go out and they fish. And we import that fish, and that fish is used in all sorts of places. And this has been talked about in Reuters and other places, you know. So we have all these slaves fishing for us. There's plenty of children and other, you know, and poor people working in clothing factories all across Asia to supply us with our cheap, nice clothing. And so we have slavery as part of the entire system. It's not the right thing to do. It's not a very spiritual way to have everybody at least, you know, being treated reasonably.
Exactly.
And so you have the slave class, or the very, you know, indentured servants class. And then you have a lot of people who are just struggling to put a roof over their head and keep themselves fed, because there's a lot of people like that in the United States. I'm not saying everybody's living in mansions. And then you have the elite class who have billions and billions of dollars, who think this is just great. And they can go to space, and they can buy all the land, and they can do whatever they want because they have billions and billions of dollars, and they're special. And everybody else is disposable to them. They don't care.
Right.
And that's what we have right now. We have the slaves, the people in between. Then you have a kind of a more of a little bit slightly higher class that are doing, you know, fairly well in all this. And then you have the elites that do whatever they want. They buy whatever they want, and they you know, now that they own everything, they just, you know, they get their jollies by controlling others. So, and, you know, this is not a healthy society at the moment. Things have to change in some way. And I think it starts with each individual person detaching from the power structures and reorganizing and getting healthier and more spiritual.
My hope is that this absolute catastrophe that's happening right now is what will catalyze that, hopefully.
Yeah.
We can
I see that happening. There are people becoming more enlightened and taking control of their own lives and their own health, and I see that more and more. And we need to go that way. Otherwise, the whole thing will eventually implode. The next microbe that, you know, supposedly comes around, you know, we're going to have to do this again and again and again and again until we say we had enough of this. We can't keep on doing this stuff. So, you know, hopefully we go in the positive direction where freedom of choice, personal responsibility, and being happy with what you kind of have and not trying to buy your way to happiness is the solution for everything. That's the main solution. It's not somebody's going to come and fix anything with high-tech solutions. It's that we all need to, you know, get back to the basics. And then I think that will help our health. I think it will help the environment. So they all play together, and it helps your happiness. You know, if you're not obsessed with these material possessions, if you're taking care of yourself, it makes all the difference.
Completely agree. So just real quick, what's the best way for people to follow you? I know you have a YouTube channel, which is how I sort of contacted you and found you. Do you have a website? Do you have other means of communicating
you can
with
go,
people?
Yeah, you can go to dissolvingillusions.com. You can email me. There's an email on there. It says dissolvingillusionsbook@gmail.com. I'm staying away from YouTube. They've already censored a couple of things, even though I was basically repeating what the FDA said in their YouTube channel. So they're getting mad at me and they're censoring me.
Yeah, I've heard that. If you even just state the government's own VAERS data or whatever, it becomes immediately misinformation.
Right.
You can be taken down.
Yeah, I took clips from the CDC, the FDA's own YouTube channel, and I got dinged for that. I complained. I said, "Hey, I'm just copying what they said," but you know, they didn't seem to care. So I'm on Odyssey. Odyssey is currently a more free platform. YouTube, you got to be careful because if you say the wrong thing, you get dinged. I know lots of people that have been smacked down, and you know, I've heard they're going to purge anything has anything that's anti-medical, you know, so I don't know how true that is, but that might be true. So yeah, I'm on Odyssey, and those are probably the best places to look.
Are you going to do what some people have been doing, which is like put a trailer on YouTube and then have the full video in Odyssey? Or, have you seen any traffic from Odyssey or people like exploring around? Because it seems like most people maybe go there when they follow a link from somewhere else.
Yeah, Odyssey is slow growing because it's new. And honestly, YouTube is a very good technical channel. It's really, really good. It's the best out there. You know, how they manage things. Yeah, how they manage. Well, yeah, so is Odyssey, but all the technical niceties. It's really, really nice, I got to say. Yeah, just can't say that. Technically, they're just awesome. So it's hard to kind of move away from that because it's so nice. But you know, it's, you know, they're not a free speech platform, so you can't say anything against the medical system currently. So get a little ticked off about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, it's completely totalitarian, to be honest with you. All right. Well, I had a really great conversation. I'm really glad we had this chance to do this.
Appreciate
you taking
out.
The time.
Sure.
I look forward to following what the upcoming book and any other projects or anything you want to plug before we go.
I got a couple things in the works, but I probably don't want to talk about them now because it's already been quite a long conversation. But I wouldn't mind coming back talking about the book Moving Back from Midnight, which is a reference to the Doomsday Clock. When that's out, and we will have a website and we will have free chapters up there So you don't even, so you can just, look at the free chapters and, start taking action without buying the book, because the object is to, transform individuals so that we make a better society. So that'll be up, but I don't know when that's going to be up. First, I want to get the book done, and then we'll do the website. And
you have some co-authors on that one?
Yeah, Catherine, Kate Schmutter. So she's down in Australia. Great, great lady. Very smart. So she's on there. So it's us two.
Great. Well, yeah, look forward to it. I would love to have you back, and it'd be great to chat with you anytime. So, yeah, let's definitely do that.
All right. You have a great day now.
All right, you too. Cheers. Thank you again.
All right, bye.
All right, bye.